Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My friend Ed Williams was editor of the editorial pages at the Charlotte Observer for, I think, more than 25 years. It seems to me all my lifetime. And during that period, he wrote sensibly and courageously about the challenges his city and our state and nation faced. And what he wrote then is still instructive and in some cases, in many cases, still inspires as they are collected in his new book called Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama. So we gathered Ed up from Charlotte, and he's brought his friend Walter Bennett, our friend and neighbor, because they have a show to tell. Now, Ed Williams, we came to talk about your essays, but why did you bring Walter Bennett?
Walter is a retired elderly person, and he has a lot of time on his hands. And I just tried to do this to give him a little meaning
You're
to his life.
Kind, considerate person.
I mean, and the fact is, I run into Walter out on the trail. He has published a very fine novel called Leaving Tuscaloosa, and we sort of met again through that. He and I were friends when he was in Charlotte many years ago. And I thought, Walter has such a wonderful voice and a great sense of the dramatic that he would be the perfect person to portray Senator Noe, Jesse Helms.
But these are your essays, aren't they? This is a collection of your editorials and essays from all the time, from the time you were a student in Mississippi.
It's kind of the arc of my career. It begins when I was a student newspaper editor at the University of Mississippi in the time when the school was integrated. There was a riot, two people were killed, and President Kennedy sent in federal troops to restore order. So it begins then, and in the latter days of the civil rights movement in Mississippi, which I reported on after I'd spent 2 years in the Army. Then I came to North Carolina, and this is where it gets interesting. I came to North Carolina because I saw it as a very progressive state with some fine newspapers. I arrived here in 1973, the same year that Jesse Helms went into the United States Senate. So there has been all this time that tension between what I regard as the progressive movement in North Carolina and some people who are anti-progressive, some would say regressive. And Jesse Helms, of course, was the greatest representative of that group during our lifetime. But Jesse Helms and I, it's fair to say we never became close. but our relations were always cordial when I would call him or run into him at something. And I wrote him a letter when he was running for the Senate.
For re-election to the Senate.
Yeah,
is
running
that right
for re-election to the Senate in 1990. But traditionally, I was running the editorial department at the Observer, and we invite political candidates to come by and tell us about what they'd do if they got elected and why they're running and that sort of thing. So it's just a pro forma thing to issue an invitation to everybody, though Senator Helms had never graced us with his presence. So I sent him a letter inviting him to come. And there ensued this exchange of letters that I thought just said so much about him. I'll say about him. Readers may judge what it says about me. But he was very gracious in his dealings with people who didn't agree with him, but also a little tart. And I think both those things come through in these letters. Why don't we just read some and let listeners see what they think?
So you're going to read your part, Walter is going to read Senator Helms' part.
Right.
And I think this is momentous to have Walter sincerely reading with appropriate intonation words that he might stumble over.
Well, that may be, or it could be that it'll be an opportunity for his true colors to show. Again, let's let listeners decide. Here we go. This is 1990. I sent Senator Helms a letter inviting him to come, and he declined, saying he thought the tenor and ferocity of our editorials over the years had led him to conclude that our minds were made up about his Senate race. And this exchange followed. I've condensed it a bit, but this is the guts of it. Dear Senator Helms, as to whether our minds are made up about the Senate race, a lot of that depends on the circumstances. In fact, I've always held out the hope that as you grow in wisdom and in stature, you will come to see the world more the way we do. I'll admit, I'm not betting my son's college savings on the chance that'll happen. But as we Baptists know, history is full of miracles. At any rate, I've never thought I had to agree with my U.S. senator to benefit from talking with him. I do hope you'll drop by. Sincerely, Ed Williams.
Dear Ed, if you ever become disenchanted with the Charlotte Observer or vice versa, I'll be glad to recommend you for a job writing for Johnny Carson. You have a fine sense of humor. My folks really enjoyed that line as to whether our minds are made up. In fact, it barely edged out your suggestion that in order to grow in wisdom and stature, it will be essential for me to come see the world the way we do. As Lou Holtz once said about your Raleigh counterpart, they have the comic page for people who can't read and the editorial page for people who can't think. As for benefiting from talking with your U.S. senator, bear in mind that I have repeatedly suggested that all of you editors might want to give me a ring and get my views on issues before launching into tirades. You have never once done so. Sincerely, Jesse.
That is Walter Bennett channeling Jesse Helms. Dear Senator Helms, I responded. Senator, that just isn't true. I've talked to you at least four or five times over the past half dozen years, most recently when I was writing about you and the Robert Mapplethorpe photos. On that occasion, you and I talked at least 10 minutes. You invited me to stop by for lunch next time I came to Washington, and you volunteered to send me some of the Mapplethorpe photos. I said I'd never thought of you as a distributor of such stuff. You sent them anyway and urged me to print them. I didn't. Jerry Shin, a former Observer Washington correspondent, tells me you wrote to one of our readers that you'd never met Jerry, when in fact, he's met you and talked with you numerous times. If I were a suspicious fellow, I might suspect you were trying to score political points by poor-mouthing about mean old editorial writers who won't even show you the courtesy of talking with you. But I know that editorialists, yourself excluded, of course, are not memorable folks, so I assume you've simply forgotten these conversations. I hope this note jogs your memory. Sincerely, Ed Williams.
Now, Ed, let me set the record straight. You have never given me a ring. Each time we've talked, it was I who placed the call, not you. I didn't urge you to print the Mapplethorpe photos. I ask only that you make them available to responsible citizens who might want to come by and see what I was talking about. As for Jerry Shin, he must be a forgettable man. I don't recall ever having talked with him. As for poor-mouthing about mean old editorial writers, another line for Johnny Carson, I don't mind you folks being mean. It's when you get nasty in your bias that intrigues me. Hang in there. You may get me yet. And the luncheon invitation still stands.
Dear
Sincerely, Jesse.
Dear Senator Helms, Senator, I beg to differ with you again. When we talked about the Mapplethorpe photos, for example, I'd called your office. Perhaps since I talked with someone else before I talked with you, you may not have known who initiated the conversation. I remember Senator Sam Ervin saying something to the effect that sometimes a good forgettery is more valuable than a good memory. Senator, it seems to me that when it comes to conversations with Observer folks, you've got a pretty good forgettery. Sincerely, Ed Williams.
Dear Ed, I did not and do not know anything about your calling some unidentified person in my office. My chief legislative assistant was sitting with me when I called the editors at Greensboro, Raleigh, and Charlotte. Since you have quoted Sam Ervin, let me do likewise. He was quite disgruntled with the Observer because, he said, you folks declined to publish his side of the argument about the genocide treaty. So he told me that the Charlotte Observer reminded him of something Lum Garrison, a town character in Morganton, once said. Those folks don't know nothing, and they got that all tangled up. Sincerely, Jesse.
Dear Senator Helms, I worry about the memory problem in your office. You've forgotten Jerry Shin. You've forgotten the other times I called you. Nobody in your office can remember my call about the National Endowment for the Arts matter. Could somebody be putting funny chemicals in your office water cooler? Come to think of it, that might explain a lot of things that come out of your office. Speaking of Senator Ervin, 3 years before his death, he sent me a long article in which he argued that South Carolina's claim to be Andrew Jackson's birthplace was spurious and North Carolina's claim was valid. I wrote back suggesting that we condense the piece a bit and use it on Andrew Jackson's birthday, about 5 months hence. A couple of days later, Senator Ervin called. He urged me to publish the piece immediately. Why? I asked. He replied with a chuckle, because I'm 85 years old, and I may not be around in 5 months. We published the piece the next week. I also remember Senator Ervin's comment about when he was a trial lawyer and he bombarded a jury with fact, analysis, biblical quotation, homespun humor, and legal history, but was unable to convince the jury of the merit of his client's case. He lamented, I had to teach them more than they were able to learn. Senator Helms, I think we've taught each other about all we're able to learn in this correspondence. My invitation to you is still open. Sincerely, Ed Williams. He didn't come, by the way.
Well, he did. He did reply to that.
Well, he did reply. Yeah. I think he enjoyed the exchange.
Yeah, but he wrote back to confirm that the interchange was now useless, but he will, and that he should stop, but he didn't.
I think he enjoyed it. You know, he spent a lifetime on television commenting on things, and I think he enjoyed the give and take. I mean, he knew what he thought, but he loved a good argument, loved a good exchange, and he got one this time, and I think he just hung on to it probably longer than his political fortunes dictated he should. I mean, we weren't going to endorse him, and he knew it. But I think he enjoyed it, and he did it for
you. Never did get around to admitting what he said, which was that he didn't have a chance to be endorsed by the—
Well, we hadn't decided at that point.
You had decided, but everybody knew.
Well, and
you
knew. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The Observer's editorial page was— and its editorial philosophy, sort of Southern progressive, and Senator Helms wasn't.
Well, speaking of those contests, and I don't want to lead you where you don't want to go, but there was an occasion when the Observer declined to endorse Senator Helms' opponent.
John Ingram, yeah. Ingram ran one of those campaigns that just left us mystified.
This was in like 1978 or so, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And what, again, you're, all the memories came flowing back with reading this, and it was an extraordinary time when you refused to endorse anybody. But
yeah.
John Ingram had defeated sort of Charlotte's favorite, Luther Hodges, mm-hmm. Jr., mm-hmm. And you all were still smarting from that in some respects, maybe.
Oh, we weren't smarting from
it. I know you don't admit to ever smarting.
No, but we don't. I mean, we don't have any investment in those candidates. If Luther Hodges had won the election, we would have been on him. But
you would have endorsed him.
Oh, I guess Senator Helms, surely, I think we would. But Ingram was a kind of populist maverick, and you never knew what he was going to do. And I didn't know, we didn't know, but what if he got to Washington, he might be somebody we disagreed with as much as or more than we felt about Helms. So, look, in a race like that, a newspaper endorsement doesn't make one vote of difference, in my opinion, because people are bombarded with messages from both sides, and there's hardly anything you can say about them that's in any way surprising or that reveals anything about them that they haven't already revealed about themselves. I mean, it's like the current U.S. Senate race here. What newspapers say on the editorial page about that Senate race is not going to change anybody's vote. The newspaper reaches fewer than half the voters in any area. The editorial page is read by much fewer than half the people who get the newspaper. The people who read the editorial pages are folks who, on big races in particular, have enough information to make up their own minds. So what we write on the editorial page about those races, as you suggested, tells more about the newspaper than it influences voters. I think on races down the ticket, A newspaper endorsement can be very useful. If you look at the number of people who are running for judgeships in North Carolina, an absolutely loony way to choose judges. But most people will go in there to vote in the Senate race or some other race and get down to the bottom of the ballot and see all those names there of people who are running for judge. That's the third branch of government. The judgeship races are enormously important, much more important in the lives of many people in this state than who's in the U.S. Senate. But, you know, they don't have any money to run unless some special interest wants to get them elected. And you get down there and you don't know a thing about it. Well, the newspaper, our newspaper at least, takes the time to at least talk to all those people and find out what they can. So they can at least warn you off somebody who has absolutely little or no legal experience or who's been in trouble with the law or is in some obvious way unsuited for the bench. So I think newspaper endorsements are very useful at that point. But on these top-of-the-ticket races, people don't look to the newspaper.
Well, I'd argue with you, but it's time for a break. So we'll take a break and come back and talk. If you joined us late, what you heard was a conversation that reflected an exchange of correspondence between our guest, Ed Williams, a former 25 years editor of the editorial pages at the Charlotte Observer, and his friend and our friend, Walter Bennett, who is playing the role of Jesse Helms. We'll be right back to talk more about Ed's book, Liberating Dixie, after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Ed Williams. Ed is the former editorial page editor of the Charlotte Observer and has collected over a lifetime from college all the way through to his retirement and then afterwards some of his comments. And these were things, as a Charlotte resident, his wisdom and just in certain cases courage in going against the establishment meant a lot then. And Ed, your words ring with wisdom for today's times as well. Do you feel that some of the lessons that we thought we learned in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and early part of this century are appropriate for what we're facing now?
Well, I think, you know, the tendency is to think that everybody lives in the present. In the present. I mean, the fact is we live with an accumulation of history that that helps shape the present. And knowing that history can help you figure out, I think, where you are and how you got there and where you're going. I think of North Carolina's inability, I would say unwillingness, to regulate industry prevent it from doing practices that are dangerous to the public and to its employees. And we all know about the coal ash problem that Duke Energy is having and how the state just neglected what I consider its duty to keep an eye on what was happening with those materials. But that's not new. I mean, if you look at North Carolina history, you find that North Carolina has always been so eager to industrialize, to escape the poverty that came with a declining agricultural system. I mean, we're so eager for jobs and industry that we essentially said, you come on in, whatever's good for industry is good for North Carolina. Well, it just plainly isn't in some cases, particularly in matters regarding employee safety and public safety. I'll cite two situations. The 1991 fire at the chicken processing plant in Hamlet killed 25 workers. When they investigated, they found out that the employers had locked the fire escape to prevent pilfering. You know, somebody might be stealing chicken wings, so they locked the fire escape. Fire started, people tried to get out, the door was locked. Then there, in the 1960s and 70s, the whole thing that the Observer won a Pulitzer Prize for writing about, brown lung in the cotton textile industry. I mean, when we started writing about that, some of the big mills said, well, that shouldn't be a political issue. The mills are trying to clean up as fast as they can. Well, some of them were, but we had this bunch of renegade mill owners who could survive economically only by providing little or no protection for their workers. Not inspected a single time by state inspectors. Never in the life of the mill inspected by a state inspector. The Hamlet chicken plant fire. All those violations were there, never inspected by a state inspector. So when you see North Carolina's apparent inability to adequately provide for the health and safety of workers and the public, that's not new. That's not new. It was part of North Carolina's scheme for industrializing to keep requirements about health and safety provisions very low. And it showed up.
Do you feel that North Carolina was special in this blindfoldedness in terms of some of the environmental risk and the worker safety risk, or was this something that was region-wide?
I think it was endemic in the South. I mean, the South, the agricultural economy in the South was so dismal that balancing industry and agriculture became the goal of every Southern state.
Even today, as we look at it with a little bit more distance, we look and see what the horrible conditions were on the farms of tenant farmers and worn out land and the health problems that were endemic to the agricultural economy and say, look, how about balancing what the choices were rather than focusing totally on the dangers that the industrial.
Well, you have to ask someone who died of bisonosis, brown lung disease, what the proper balance is. I mean, the fact is the state in licensing those industries takes on some responsibility to see that they're operating in a way that's not dangerous to the public or to workers. And the North Carolina is certainly not alone. Other Southern states with a kind of hunger, a need for that kind of job opportunity did the same thing. I don't think you can posit that in order to have a successful industry, you have to kill workers. I guess that's the point I'm making. To me, the balance falls somewhere way short of knowingly creating conditions that injure or kill
workers. Is there anything going on now that you see that is strongly and is detrimental to the workers as you all brought to light in the textile industry?
I think the protections for workers are much better. Now, you'll find places where they aren't. There are some jobs that are just dangerous. You mentioned farm work. That's the most dangerous kind of occupation. I grew up on a farm. I had six cousins who were missing a finger from working on farm machinery. But I think the environmental stuff comes closest to me to creating that kind of concern. I don't know about fracking. I have friends who say it's safe and friends who say it isn't. But I worry that the state's eagerness to proceed with that may outpace its ability to ensure the safety of it. I think that's just something we need to keep an eye on. I worry about air and water pollution. I think those are things we need to care about. This is a General Assembly that's loosened what I thought were some pretty good regulations in that regard. The political pendulum swings back and forth, and I think
so. The risk that you see are more in the environmental area.
I don't think that
are public health matters rather than those specific to particular industries.
Now, probably as soon as we say this, somebody who's representing a worker who's been grossly mistreated in an industry is going to call up. But I don't see the kind of industry-wide problem that we had in bisonosis, brown lung, in the textile industry. I think the textile industry, such as it still exists, has come way beyond that and was doing so, in fact, when we were riding in the responsible parts of the industry. The problem is that without state regulation, you open things up for the wildcats to do dangerous things if you don't inspect them. And I think that inspecting is just a way for the state to say, yeah, we're keeping an eye on that. If we find something that's unsafe, we're going to try to get it straightened out. But I think overall, industrial safety in particular has come forward very rapidly since that time. But I do worry about things we don't know about, and particularly in the environmental area.
We're visiting with Ed Williams. We're talking with him in connection with the publication of his new book, Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with my friend Ed Williams from Charlotte. He's the editorial page editor of the Charlotte Observer for more than 25 years. He's collected much of his writings over his whole career in a book called Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama. Tell us about the title.
Well, there are two parts of it. One is Liberating Dixie, and that arose from my study of Wilbur J. Cash, another Charlotte editorial writer.
Why do you call him Wilbur J.? We always, W.J. Cash, what's the deal? Well, around here, we like initials.
Well, you guys probably can't remember his first name. I just wanted to show I could. But he wrote a book called Mind of the South, published in the early 1940s. And as a student, I was a history major at the University of Mississippi in the early 1960s, and I had a professor named James Silver, a Chapel Hill Phi Beta Kappa graduate who earned a PhD from Vanderbilt. Silver was kind of a maverick historian in that he wouldn't let the Southern patriots get together with creating a vision of the Southern past that never was. I mean, he kept calling them to account on things about slavery and the continued practice of racial discrimination in the South. Made him quite unpopular. Eventually, he was run out of the state, more or less, by people who were trying to get him. But at any rate, in one of his classes, I read The Mind of the South. And in it, Cash talks about the effort by people who were trying to preserve every facet of the Southern way of life from any sort of criticism at all. Started before the Civil War with efforts to not just discourage criticism of slavery, but punish people for doing it. And after the war, it came forward to suppressing any kind of dissent about the Southern racial arrangements made after the war, about the forced segregation and the oppression of blacks in the South, and it spread across Southern society. You couldn't criticize Southern literature. You couldn't criticize the way women dressed. You couldn't criticize Southern religion. Any of that stuff would get you in trouble with a lot of the people who thought everything in the South was perfect. Well, Cash's point, and I think to some degree his mission, was to liberate the South from that kind of suppression of freedom of speech. His theory was that we weren't going to move past where we were unless we could talk about where we were and where we wanted to go. And I thought he was exactly right. And I was in Mississippi as a student at the time of the race riot that accompanied the coming of James Meredith as the first black student at Ole Miss. And Mississippi, there was no other Southern state like Mississippi in this regard. In the early 1960s, when James Meredith was moving through the federal courts to get a court order admitting him to Ole Miss, Mississippi was also celebrating the centennial of the Civil War, a war that many in Mississippi thought had ended with a truce and not a Northern victory. And Ross Barnett, the governor of the state, was going around the state wearing a Confederate officer's uniform, making passionate patriotic speeches saying things like this: "The Civil War was the opportunity your forefathers had to stand up against Northern oppression. These efforts to integrate our public schools and public facilities today are your opportunity to stand up against Northern oppression." Well, I mean, that created a kind of passion among Southerners who not only believed they had a patriotic duty to stand up against court orders ordering admission of blacks into public facility, not only a patriotic duty, but an opportunity to win that argument. And it was just they had taken leave of their senses. But it was not it would have been hard for them to maintain any other sort of view, because the press in Mississippi, all the public officials in Mississippi, virtually every influential and knowledgeable public voice in Mississippi said, yeah, we got to do this and we can win. Well, I mean, you see what happened. James Meredith came to Ole Miss, a night of rioting. Two people were killed. Federal troops came in, occupied the state. And sure enough, Mississippi had to obey the law. So it was a hard time, and Mississippi, I think, was the purest example of that kind of situation that Cash was talking about, where the South needed to be liberated from that oppressive effort by people in power to keep folks from really understanding.
So that's your title coming from Cash's notion of liberation rather than the governor's attitude of we'll liberate Dixie by fighting, standing up to the...
Yeah, I mean, here's what Cash was talking about, that in a place where you don't have freedom to think, freedom to debate, freedom to argue, you're in trouble because you have only the point of view that is force-fed to you by the people who are in power. And Cash thought that was disastrous for the South during the mid-1860s and had continued to be disastrous for the South up until the time he'd written
The title, you want to talk about the title, and the title implies the Liberating Dixie, and then you got a time period from Ole Miss to Obama, that the South is the process that's complete.
That's the process that I completed by retiring. In fact, the process is not complete. Liberating Dixie is a work in progress. Liberating the American mind is a work in process. I mean, we have these odd notions about our state and our city and our country that a fair and even-handed examination of history would suggest are myth. And I think when we see ourselves in a way that is contrary to our history, we run a risk of getting ourselves into things thinking that we're vastly different from other people.
Ed, in your discussion, really a very interesting discussion of Cash coming out of your classroom in Mississippi. You had to go to Mississippi to get informed about a North Carolina, one of our heroic writers.
One hopes North Carolina is informing its students.
I don't think anybody's really going as deeply into it as you did. And one of the things that you mentioned was that Cash was influenced by Mencken.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, our friend Hal Crowther's book on Mencken is coming out along the way, in which we learn that these guys, in order to stand up, I don't want to say you had to be mean-spirited, but you had to be oblivious to what your neighbors and what your friends thought. You just had to go launch into this and declare yourself to be right and attack as Mencken did. And I guess in some respects, Cash was willing to go up sort of against his friends and neighbors. Were you willing to do that?
I think Mencken had a personality problem. You know? I mean, there are some people who enjoy chewing on their neighbors. I never did. The reason I went to the Charlotte Observer and stayed there rather than trying to go to, you know, be a foreign correspondent somewhere is that I wanted to live in a community, and I wanted to have a role in shaping life in that community through the newspaper. And I thought that having a newspaper that tried to speak honestly and openly about the problems of a community helped people who were trying to deal with it. We mentioned newspaper editorials, and I said I didn't think they made much difference at the top of the ticket.
We had to take a break because I didn't want to argue with you about that.
Well, so you may want to argue with me later, but that's okay because creating an argument is part of what it's about. When I say what I think, you say what you think, and then people who are listening can kind of see what the choices are in those things. So I don't think you have to. I mean, I may be out of step with the times, but I don't think you have to think your adversaries are fools or knaves in order to disagree with them. I mean, there throughout the history of North Carolina and of this country, there have been very differing views about what's the proper way to go forward, from Andrew Hamilton versus Thomas Jefferson to Jesse Helms versus almost everybody to the Republicans and Democrats today. I mean, there's a strong and, I think, honorable debate about what's the best way forward. And I think that the public and the commonweal benefit if we have that debate. I think they suffer if we don't. And I worry that today the voices are so strident and oftentimes mean-spirited that they discourage reasonable people from wanting
to engage. You know what you sound like? You sound like Kay Hagan. You're the most moderate of the radical editors that Jesse Helms told us to be suspicious of?
I don't see anything radical about myself as an editor. I mean, after we did endorsements, people used to call me and say, well, we know about you. And I said, well, look, if there's anybody who doesn't have a secret agenda, it's me. I mean, everything I think is right there in the newspaper. You can agree with it or disagree with it. The thing we try to do at The Observer, we didn't want to win arguments by silencing the opposition. So in the editorials, that was our voice in those columns on the editorial page. Letters to the editor, if you wrote a letter to the editor disagreeing with us, you had a better chance of getting it printed mm-hmm. than if you agreed with us. On the op-ed page, and in those days we had a full op-ed page, my goal was that when you read that page, you wouldn't have any idea where the editors of The Observer sit on the issue, that we ought to give conservatives and liberals and people who are off the political scales.
I'm tired of this defense of the Charlotte Observer and its editorial, but point well taken. You've been very persuasive, but I got to take a break if we're going to have any time for another section.
All right, you may.
thank you. I'm visiting with my buddy Ed Williams, who's wise words have been collected in his wise words in his editorial writing and essay writing over a career have been collected in a new book called Liberating Dixie. He and I will be right back to talk about it after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Ed Williams, who is the author of a book that it took him more than 50 years to write. It's called Liberating Dixie, and it's a collection of his essays, editorials, all the way from the time he was a student of the University of Mississippi and editor of that school's newspaper until past retirement, where, although retired from 25 years of writing editorials and essays for the Charlotte Observer, he still contributes from time to time. So, Ed, we've taken up a lot of time, and it's been so much fun. You brought a great program, but we hadn't given you the chance to say what's your favorite part of your book.
Well, it's interesting, D.G. Newspaper editorial pages tend to be heavy on public policy stuff. When I was editorial page editor at The Observer, I started each day with two blank pages, and I could put anything on there that I wanted to unless the publisher told me to stop. And fortunately, two out of three publishers didn't. So I wanted the feeling of The Observer's editorial page to be the way you'd feel about a neighbor whom you'd talk to across the back fence. You may not agree with all the time, but you found him kind of interesting. And if we could have readers feel that way about us, then I'd feel like I was getting through with what I wanted the page to be. So I wrote a lot about family, wrote a lot about the arts, wrote a lot about religion. I mean, our readers care very much about religion. And while my religious views may not have satisfied somebody like Jerry Falwell, the fact is that there's a wide variety of thinking and feeling about religion in our city and in our region that people want to be exposed to. In fact, the most popular piece I ever wrote had to do with my experience of a young man that I ran into in a shopping mall in Florida when I was down there for a newspaper convention who had AIDS. And he needed some money to get home for Christmas. He said for the first time his family had invited him to come home for Christmas after shunning him once he developed AIDS. But he said he needed some money to get home, so I gave him $20. And
did you just happen to have $20 and not a $10 bill
did.
in your wallet?
Well, I guess I'm good for up to $20. But the interesting thing was I'd been part of a Bible study class at my church when we were studying what Jesus had said to people who were going to inherit the kingdom, and they'd helped him, he said, when he was down and out. And they said, when did we do this? And he said, inasmuch as you did it to any of the least of these.
So when they ask you, you got at least one.
And this guy, after I'd given him the money, he was getting ready to go away, and he turned around and he said, I think you're Jesus. And you can imagine how shocked I was, because what I was thinking was, I thought you were Jesus. Well, because helping you know, the least of these. And that column just resounded with so many people. I mean, you measure your success as a column writer by how many refrigerator doors your columns get stuck on. A lot of magnets holding that one up, and I still get requests for. So, you know, I just want to talk about things that were important to me, and religion is, and family is, and the arts are, and education is, and the how society and government treat people who are needy. That matters a lot to me.
Well, you've done good, and you've done good with us today, sharing not just your book, but your passion and your commitment to an informed, vigorous, but civil debate. And that's a great contribution, of the great contributions.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks to Ed Williams, the author of Liberating Dixie and Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama, for sharing his thoughts with us. And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be with you before you know it.